असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्युर्मा अमृतं गमय ॐ शांति 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 ॐ लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल लीड अस फ्रॉम डार्कनेस अन टू लाइट लीड अस फ्रॉम डेथ टू इमॉर्टैलिटी ॐ peace, peace, peace. Good morning and namaste, everybody. Welcome. A bright and beautiful day here in Manhattan. The subject, you might have noticed, is the honey of non-duality. And that sounds sweet, pun intended, but what does it mean? It actually refers to a text called the Advaita Makaranda, a little-known text of post-Shankara Advaita Vedanta. This text, the author was one Lakshmidhara Kavi, and it's little-known. I mean, I had never heard of it when I was studying Vedanta initially, and I just read it only recently. It was popularized by Swami Dayananda Saraswati from the Arshavidya. The first translation, I think, into English was by Swami Tejomayanandaji from the Chinmay Mission. And then recently, our very own Swami Atmarupanandaji, who was in Houston, now he's in Paris in the Vedanta Center there, he has translated this. And he has named it the Nectar of Non-Duality. You can translate it either way. The idea being here that the author's idea is that already all these traditions exist. The Upanishads are very ancient, they already exist. And then the commentaries of Shankaracharya are there, and so many post-Shankara Advaita masters have written about it. So there are many, many texts. Now what this author, his vision is, he's like a bee which goes to a honeybee, you know, which goes to different flowers. All these texts are different flowers. And he goes and he extracts the honey, you know, like they extract the nectar out of the flowers, the bees, and then they mix it together to make honey, which they present to us. So exactly like that, this text is like the essence, the sweet essence of all the other texts. So basically what he has done is, he has gathered insights and arguments from various non-dual texts over, you know, centuries or millennia. So he's gathered it together into this honey of non-duality. And it's a short text, about 28 verses, but it's very unique, and there's a reason why I have selected it. One practical reason is that I'm studying it all over again right now for the first time for the purpose of teaching it. I've studied it myself for myself earlier, but I am scheduled to teach this text later in September this year in Phoenix. So I thought I'll give you a taste of the honey, you know, and take it for a test run in this. Now, this text, it demands attention. Why? It's a little different from all other texts, and that's why it's intriguing and very interesting and sweet. In Advaita Vedanta, the process is, the method is hearing, reflecting, meditating. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Typically, you would go to the Upanishads and a number of other later texts to know an answer to the question, what does Vedanta say? What is Vedanta teaching us? And we learn from that. We learn the central message of Vedanta. In Advaita Vedanta, it's pretty simple, actually. I mean, it's a vast system. So many texts, so many masters spread over centuries and millennia, and yet it can be reduced to very simple statements. You are Brahman. Tattvamasi, that thou art. Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya Jiva Brahmaivanapara. Brahman is the ultimate reality, the only reality. The world is an appearance, and you are Brahman. You, the sentient being, you are Brahman. So this is, you can state it in very brief, in a single sentence, you can put the entire teaching. Now, the second stage, after you know what Vedanta is teaching, we know what Vedanta is telling us, that somehow we are Brahman, that we are the absolute reality, existence, consciousness, bliss. And then we have questions. So when we have questions, we go to into the second state, the second stage of Vedantic learning, Vedantic study and practice. It's practice, actually. The second stage is reflection, reasoning. We try to answer the questions. For example, how am I Brahman? I don't feel like that. I don't see at all how I am Brahman. It's impossible. So this doubt, impossibility doubt, that in Sanskrit it's called asambhavana, literally impossibility doubt. It's impossible that I'm Brahman. It's just crazy. Now I have to be convinced. I have to be shown. I have to be shown that I am in error of what I think about myself. And this stage is manana, or reasoning. And then there is a further stage, which is nididhyasana, Vedantic meditation, where the problem is, our question is, that yes, now I know what Vedanta teaches me, I am Brahman. And now also through the process of reasoning, I am quite convinced that I get it now. I get it, I understand in what sense, what is the meaning of this teaching. It's clear to me now. And it's great. But I still have problems living it. You know, it doesn't still, I still feel like the same old guy, and I react, what's worse is I still react to life not as limitless consciousness, but just this guy, as I used to. Maybe a little better, or maybe a little worse, but now that I'm Brahman, no. So how do I make this a living truth for me? And that is the third stage, is there are techniques of meditation where you immerse yourself in the clarity already gained. I'll repeat that. Vedantic meditation is to immerse yourself in the clarity that you've already gained through the first two stages. Now, this text, the one which we are going to go into today, which we are going to get a taste of today, is unique in the sense that it refers to that second stage of Vedantic, the procedure. You know, it sort of assumes that we know what Vedanta is all about. So if there are absolute newcomers here, apologies to them. One senior Swami would say, when you give a talk, there should be something for everybody, and there should be something for everybody and everything for some people at least. But today it might not be something for everybody, because it already assumes familiarity with non-dual Vedanta. Then when we have this question, how am I Brahman? This is where the text comes in. What it wants to do is pretty radical. It wants to use our present experience, the experience of life as we have it right now, and to show us that you are Brahman. It's pretty clear. It's pretty easy. It's pretty obvious. We'll just make it clear to you. We will show you through argument and experience. What experience? Just the experience that we have already, that you are Brahman. It's a pretty, as we shall see, it's a big task. It's a difficult thing to do. And therefore, what he will do is a set of arguments based on our experience, trying to convince you that you are Brahman right now, to make it clear. And also, not just arguments, it's also based on experience. At the end of it, we will not actually say that, all right, now I understand how I am Brahman, but I yet have to experience it. That's how most people react. No, the author doesn't want us to do that. The author, at the end of this session, or the text at least, if we begin to get it, we should say both, I understand what is meant by I am Brahman, and also I experience it. That's what the author is claiming, that experience is already available. Let me just dwell on this for a couple of minutes before going ahead. I mentioned this earlier. There are different paradigms of spiritual life. You know, all the great mystical traditions, spiritual traditions in the great religions of the world, they operate on different paradigms. Three main paradigms I'll bring before you today. They're central. One is the devotional paradigm. The devotional paradigm is there is God. You know, in some form, atheistic religions, all of them believe in God. There's God in some form, in some conception of God, and God exists. And our duty, our method of approaching God is devotion, faith, love, surrender, worship, prayer, music, meditation, all of that. The purpose being to connect ourselves to God, who's a real presence, to feel the presence of God and get the grace of God. By the grace of God, we shall be free from the travails of samsara, from our sorrow, and attain happiness and fulfillment. It comes from there. We just open ourselves to it and we want it and we remain tuned to the presence of God. All of this is called bhakti. Bhakti, devotion, love of God. And it's not uncommon. I mean, if you look at the theistic religions in the world, they are all sort of so different models of bhakti. Just, you know, all of it. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Vaishnavism, Shaktism, the devotional stuff that we do here, Sri Ramakrishna, all of it is bhakti. Then there's another approach in spiritual life. That is the yogic approach, the meditation approach, which you find in Patanjali Yoga, you find it in Buddhism, in Jainism, in Sankhya, where the premise, the paradigm is not that there is a God and you have to believe in God and then have faith and by the grace of God you will be delivered or saved. No, the paradigm is that you are that ultimate truth, you are pure consciousness, you have to know yourself as you truly are, and the way to know yourself as you truly are is meditation. Meditation. Because the problem here is not one of, you know, lack of belief. In bhakti, the problem is a lack of belief, lack of faith. And the solution is faith in God and surrender to God. But in the yogic approach, the problem is restlessness of the mind. And the paradigm is that if you calm the mind down, if you sufficiently settle the mind and focus it in that stillness, in a pure and still mind, your inner, your reality, Purusha, the pure consciousness, that shines forth and becomes clear to you. And that is enlightenment. And that's also a particular paradigm. Problem, restlessness of mind, solution is calming the mind down in meditation. And there are many traditions which take this approach. Multiple forms of meditative practices. Now what we are going to do in this text today is neither of these. The author will not ask us to believe in something and then surrender and have faith and all. No, not at all. The author also will not ask us to close our eyes and stop thinking. Don't stop thinking and don't close your eyes. I mean, especially hot, humid day, it's a hazard. You'll fall asleep immediately. Hot, humid day and high philosophy make for a very bad combination. A very soporific combination. So what the author expects, the Advaitic paradigm, is insight. Not believing in something, not even doing meditation to get some kind of extraordinary mystical experience which we do not have at this time. No. As we shall see, as we shall go into this, we'll see he's only appealing to our experience which we have right now, already, effortlessly we have it. Perhaps we do not notice it or we do not understand its implications. So what the author will do in this text is draw our attention to some clear fact of our experience all the time. All of us have it. And then draw out the implications and then we begin to see, hopefully. So this is a very radical approach. This is, nowadays it's called the direct path. You know, that instantaneous, effortless, where everybody is very happy. Oh, so I don't have to put in years and years of practice. Effortless, right now. And right now, not years and years, and not lots of hard practice, but effortless and instantaneous. Yes, in some sense, true. If you get it, at that moment, it's effortless and instantaneous. If you don't get it, it could be years and years of hard practice. Yeah, we have to keep at it, no doubt. All right. With this background, I shall start. So what we are called upon to do is listen carefully first. What is the text saying? What is the author saying to us? And then try to get it to the steps of the argument. It's going to be very closely argued. A lot of packed arguments here. I'll try to make it as simple as possible. But it is going to be intense. It's like a slightly prolonged TED Talk. So a lot of ideas put in a short time. First listen carefully. Second, try to get it, follow the steps of the argument and connect the whole argument, put it together. And third, it's not just about arguing and reasoning and trying to understand, but also seeing it as a fact. It's as much of an Vivekananda called it an open secret. It's secret, that's why we need to hear it, because we don't know it, it's not common sense. But it's also open. So if it's right here, right now, what you're talking about, that I am Brahman, I need to match it with my experience. So it's going to be very intense, and I think this talk will require a Q&A, a question answer. So today, after a long time, we'll follow up the talk with a Q&A, a short Q&A. We'll finish the talk, and then we'll give a 10-minute break. Those who want to leave or just want to stretch your legs and come back, you're free to do that, and then we'll reassemble here for the Q&A. I still haven't started, and we've got 15 minutes into the talk. All right, but I think this background was necessary. What the author wants to do, he has a particular strategy. The strategy is this. If two things fit the same definition, they're the same thing. If Brahman is Sat, Chit, Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, limitless being, limitless awareness, limitless fulfillment, joy, bliss, Sat, Chit, Ananda, that formulation. And if it can be shown that I am Sat, Chit, Ananda to my satisfaction, then I must be Brahman. This is a simple strategy. The task before the author is to convince us that you are limitless existence, limitless consciousness, and limitless joy or fulfillment. That's your real nature. And as through reason, you must give a check mark that yes, check, I understand. The arguments hold up. And not only that, more important, as a fact. So that's why I say, because it is both reasoning and experience, I think that it's not just Manana Grantha, a text of reasoning, the second stage, is also a text of meditation, because it's continuously pointing out what you are. All right. So the definition of Brahman, this is the strategy, the definition of Brahman, which we find in the Vedanta text, that's why we need to be a little familiar with what Vedanta teaches us. The broad definitions of Brahman, which are very famous actually, and found in the Vedanta text, the original Vedanta text, the Upanishads, and then trying to match it with ourselves. This is the strategy. All right. The first well-known definition, formulation of Brahman always is, Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss. Though you don't find exactly that formulation in the Upanishads, you will find famously in the Taittiriya Upanishad, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, infinite existence, consciousness is Brahman. And then there's another separate definition, Anandam Brahma Vyajanat, no Ananda, bliss to be Brahman. You can put them together. So Sat Chit Ananda, limitless. It's not that Brahman is something that exists. It is existence itself, as Vivekananda said. It's not that Brahman is something that knows. It is knowledge itself or consciousness itself. It's not that Brahman is something that's very happy. It's happiness itself or bliss itself. So Sat Chit Ananda, that formulation. And the whole purpose being that once we realize ourselves as that, once we see as a fact, we'll also see immediately, simultaneously, that we are actually beyond suffering. We are beyond death. Body will die, but if I am Sat Chit Ananda and I can clearly see that, then I will not die. It will be also obvious to me. Should be. It is the mind which goes through ups and downs, through depression, anxiety, fear, desire, frustration. But if I'm not the mind, I am Sat Chit Ananda, I have no fear at all, no anxiety at all, no depression at all. It should become clear to me. So this is the strategy. It's a powerful strategy, but it's a big claim. Let's see how well it holds up under examination. All right. With this background, let's dive into the first verse. The first verse is most important, where he reveals his whole strategy, the author. The first verse goes like this. Aham asmi sada bhami na kadachin naham apriyah. Brahme vaham mato siddham satchidananda lakshanam. Simple Sanskrit. He's a poet. So sometimes his Sanskrit is also very beautiful, simple but very beautiful. He says in this verse, in this shloka, in this verse, he says, I am. Aham asmi. I am. Bhami. I shine. When? Sada. All the time. And at no time, I am not beloved to myself. I'll explain all of it. Therefore, I am Brahman, that's established, which is existence consciousness bliss, which is defined in the books as existence consciousness bliss. Now, what does this mean? There's a lot to unpack here. First, I am. In all our experience of life, whatever experience we have in life, there is a background factor, a constant factor, which we overlook all the time. And the author wants to bring our attention to that factor. Right now, in our experience, whatever, you know, you're sitting here, listening, I'm standing here, talking, you know, all these experiences, there is the background experience of my own existence, that I am. This I am-ness is present all our lives, throughout our lives, in every experience that we have. You see, when I'm looking at this flower, it's not that, you know, an accurate description of this flower would be that it's not just a flower, it's a flower in my experience. Isn't that a more truthful, accurate, real way of putting it? It's not just a flower. A more complete way of describing it is, I am seeing the flower. And notice, when you shift your attention and look at the podium, flower is different, podium is different. Now you'll say the an accurate way of describing this would be, I am looking at the podium. I am remains constant. The flower and the podium are different. You might say looking also remains constant. But then if I say, I am listening to what you are saying, Swami. So your words, I am listening. Looking changed into listening. The flower changed into the podium, changed into your words. But I am remained constant. Whatever you see, I am seeing is true. The I am is there. Conversely, very interesting. A simple fact, but dramatic fact. When you're looking at me, you're seeing me right now. I am seeing you, Swami. And close your eyes. Clearly, you are not seeing me now. I am not seeing you. But I am is still there. Right? Open your eyes now. So, I am, I have to be careful about that. Some will go deep into samadhi and then. When I'm seeing you, I'm there. When I close my eyes, I do not see you. I'm still there. Nobody doubts this. When I'm hearing you, I'm there. If I plug my ears and I don't hear anything at all, I'm still there. But reverse this. Just as a thought experiment, think, suppose I am was not there. This I am feeling, this I am-ness, it was not there. Would seeing still happen? No. Would hearing still happen? No. Thinking? No. That I am is crucial. Follow this. Some of you are with me or some of you are puzzled. This is a thought experiment. I am seeing. Now I am not seeing, but I am still there. This I am, suppose it was not there. No I am. Suppose, what would be there? Nothing, as far as I am concerned, nothing. Just blankness, complete zero. This I am is constant in all experiences. The objects of experience come and go. Whatever I see, I am there. Whatever I hear, smell, taste, touch, I am is constant. And it's the same I am. The objects are different. The senses are different. Seeing is different from hearing is different from smelling is different from touching. But I am is constant, and it's the same I am. And then let's go to our inner experiences of thinking. See, senses are external. We are contacting an external world. We see, hear, smell, taste, touch. But internally, we all have a private life. We think. We remember. When we think, different thoughts, so many thoughts come to our mind. But each thought is shining in the light of I am. We ignore the I am. We are absorbed in what we are seeing, what we are thinking, what we are feeling, but I am is constant. So the author brings our attention to the I am, which is our constant experience. Aham asmi. When? I am. Yeah, I am, that's true. But what's the big deal about it? Not only I am, sada asmi, all the time. In all our experiences, the I am is there. In fact, without the I am, we cannot conceive of any experience. Experience is not possible without the I am for me. So I am is constant. In our inner lives also, whatever thought comes and goes, the I am is there. Whatever emotion comes and goes, when I'm feeling great, I am feeling great. I am. When I'm feeling down in the dumps, I am feeling down in the dumps. It's the same I am which was feeling great. It's the same I am which is feeling down in the dumps, depressed. That means by nature, the I am must be free of feeling great or feeling depressed. Those things come and go. But the I am is constant in all the emotions. Throughout my waking life, I am. And when I fall asleep and dream, I am. In the dream too, I am. When I wake up, I will dismiss the dream, that it was all a dream. But I could not deny that I experienced it. I dreamt it. So I am was there in the dream. Even in deep sleep, Advaita Vedanta, we've talked about this many times, Advaita Vedanta would say deep sleep is not an absence of experience. It's an experience of absence. It is the I am revealing a blankness, an absence of objects to be experienced. In waking, dreaming, deep sleep, I am. All the time. Aham asmi, sada asmi, all the time. And it cannot be denied. It's the one thing that we cannot deny in our experience. It goes back to 400, 300 years or so, Descartes. You know, we all read the Cartesian coordinates in mathematics and all. The French mathematician and philosopher. And his project, famous project of doubting whatever could be doubted. Whatever could be doubted, he doubted. Suppose this world, how do I know it exists? I could be dreaming. And he was so far ahead of his time, virtual reality. He said, suppose there's an evil demon, we can project reality to my senses. Just like virtual reality. So, what meta and virtual reality glasses and Oculus, all those things are there. Suppose there's something like that is happening. Long before the Matrix movie, Descartes says, suppose there's an evil demon which projects my world. How will I know this is a real world or just projected? And so I can doubt whatever, even what I see, hear, smell, taste, touch, which seems to be real to me, I can doubt it. In dreams also that happens. In virtual reality today that happens. But the one thing he found he could not doubt was his own existence. You cannot doubt the doubter. If the doubt is there, then there's a doubter. If the thought is there, then the thinker, I exist because I think. I think, therefore I exist. The cogito ergo sum. He could not deny his own existence. So he had found the rock bottom, the solid basis on which to build up knowledge. So his project of skepticism, for that he found a ground for knowledge. That is, in the existence of this I am. Undeniable. 800, nearly 1,000 years before Descartes, Shankaracharya writes, Yaeva tasya nirakarta tasyaeva atmasa. Whoever denies the existence of the self is the self itself. It's his own self. So if you deny your own existence, you are that one. You have proved it by the very act of denying that you exist. Yeah. Same thing. You cannot deny this I am. Sada asmi. And this I am is constant. See, we have this kind of feeling that, you know, I feel that this world exists and it's really existing. It's changing all the time. I am unchanging. But this world was there before I am came into being. And this world will continue and I am will die one day. We think like that. It's very strange. I find myself, I am, to be unchanging in all my experiences. Yet I have this intuition that I'm going to die one day. Because everybody else is dying, so I'll die. This question of death, very interesting. We don't have an experience of death. None of us. So aren't you a Hindu Swami? You must have died thousands of times earlier. Yes, but the body died. As a Hindu, it's a fact that I have, I believe in rebirth. In that case, I believe that there is no death. Because it's the body died, and if I'm still there, then I have not died. Nobody has an experience of death that is a complete cessation. In fact, it's logically impossible. You cannot experience your complete extinction. If you are extinguished, then what is experiencing anything at all? You cannot logically experience your own death. Why do we feel that this I am will die one day? We'll come to that little later. But it's not just I am. Notice, this I am is shining. Aham asmi sada bhami. I not only exist all the time, I am all the time, but I also shine. Shine not in the sense of light. It's not that you're radioactive or something. It means that you are of the nature of consciousness, awareness. Just as nothing in this room would be visible until we switched on the light. And the light reveals everything in this room which is non-luminous. It is revealed by light. And the light reveals itself. You don't need to switch on this other light to see that light. No. So the light has a unique nature of illumining everything and revealing itself also. But more than that, it's not the light does is not really self-luminous. It's you, to you, the consciousness, the light is revealed. So you are the light of lights. Every evening we sing here to Sri Ramakrishna, Jyoti Ra Jyoti. Light of lights. Ujala Ridikandara. Shining in our hearts. What is the light of lights shining in our hearts? It's nothing other than consciousness, awareness. So this I am is not only an existing thing, like a table or a chair is an existing thing. No, not like that. It's also a shining reality. You exist all the time. You are all the time. And you shine all the time, ceaselessly. All of our waking life is revealed to you, the consciousness, the I am awareness. All of our dreams are revealed, your dreams, are revealed to you, the consciousness, the I am awareness. And even the darkness of deep sleep is revealed to you, I am the awareness. You are not extinguished in deep sleep. You know, Descartes should have gone one step further. That it's not that I think, therefore I am. Vedanta would say, I am, therefore I think. When I do not think, suppose I don't think, have I disappeared? But the same logic, you know, when I look at you, I am there. If I don't look at you, have I disappeared? For me, you have disappeared, but have I disappeared to myself? No. In that case, if I don't see, hear, smell, taste, touch, I am is still there. If I don't think, remember, feel, desire, I am is still there. Just not expressing itself in any particular way. The Upanishad says, so he's always drawing upon the Upanishads. Upanishad says, in the Kathopanishad, Mundaka Upanishad, beautiful mantras. Tameva bhantam anubhati sarvam tasya bhasa sarvamidam vibhati. That shining, everything else shines here. By its light, everything here is revealed. You shining. Everything shines. Shines means is revealed. You know, it's known. Like the light shining, all the chairs and tables and things in the people in this room are known. By your light, everything here is revealed. You shining, the mind shines with, you know, thoughts, feelings, emotions become apparent to you. And the mind shining, then the senses shine. It's only when the mind is awake, you are able to see, hear, smell, taste, touch. And the senses shining, the world is revealed to you. So you by your light, everything else is revealed. That is called bhami, sada bhami. All the time I am shining. I am all the time I am shining. Then one more thing he points out, the author. Kadachit naham apriyaha. Here is drawing upon, to my best knowledge, upon the masterpiece, Vedantic masterpiece, the Panchadashi. In the first chapter of the Panchadashi, the great master Vidyaranya Swami, he wants to show us that this I am, this isness consciousness. By the way, sometimes I use the term isness. So I used to think that I came up with it. And I found in the Inspired Talks of Swami Vivekananda, he says, this isness which is everywhere. And within quotes, he says exactly the same isness. There in the Panchadashi, by argument, he wants to show that we are of the nature of bliss. So the argument, he gives a twofold argument, which is encapsulated here by the author Lakshmidhara. The twofold argument to show what? You are bliss itself, or ananda itself, or joy itself. How does he want to prove that to us, or point it out to us? He says, this is Vidyaranya, I'm quoting from there. Whatever gives us happiness, pleasure, joy in this world, we like that. So the kinds of food which give us pleasure, we like those kinds of food. The people who make us happy, we like those people. Yeah. So, and whatever we like, we want to keep. We want to hang around with the people who make us happy. We like them. We want to eat the foods which give us pleasure. We like it. We like those foods. We want to go to the places. We want to do the job. We want to do those spiritual practices and so on and so forth. All of which give us happiness. And that which does not give us happiness, we want to get rid of. We want to avoid. Yeah. That kind of, you know, it could be the same thing. The gadget which I really liked, which I thought will give me a lot of happiness, and I queued up in Black Friday to buy it, and I got it at a lot of effort. Few years later, what junk? I have to get rid of it. What happened? The gadget might think, if it could think that, what happened to you? You got me from the shop with so much trouble, and now you want to throw me out on the street. Why? Because, gadget, you gave me a lot of happiness at that time, but you don't give me happiness now. So that which gives me happiness, I want it. I want to buy it. I want to keep it. I want to increase it. That which does not give me happiness, I want to get rid of it. I want to avoid it. All right, so this is understood. Now, the argument is there is one thing which we always want. We want its company, we want to keep it, we want to keep it all the time, and we never ever want to get rid of it. What's that? Ourselves. Ourselves. We ourselves. We want the tremendous urge to live in this body. Yes, the Vedanta will say that you identify yourself entirely with this body, that's why you want to keep this body going. But basically what you want to keep going is yourself. And you know, science fiction is full of stories of how one day you'll be able to upload yourself into the cloud or something. Then all right, then we'll be very happy, let the body die. I can as long as I continue. You know, all Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, and you know, who believe in rebirth, we believe that at one point the body dies and we lose contact with this body. We are very happy. Let them burn it, bury it, whatever. Because I know I continue without that body. So my continuity, I always want. I never want to finish off myself. And I can know what you're all thinking. What about suicide? What about all those people who want to kill themselves? In fact, I have a documentary shoot coming up for the National Mental Health Week where I'm supposed to speak out against suicide. So what about suicide? People who want to die then. Notice, in the case of suicide, it's not really that they want to get rid of themselves. They want to get rid of associated problems. Somebody has a terrible debt and sees no way of paying off the debt and wants to kill himself or herself. They say that when the Great Depression hit, 1929, the people who jumped off from the, what building was that? Empire State Building at that time? The World Trade Center? No. Empire State, 1929. The Financial Center. Some people just jumped off. They saw they have lost everything with beyond any hope of recovery of anything. Just went up the window and jumped. I saw this cartoon of a psychiatrist. He's sitting in a typical thing, and I think must be in Manhattan then. He's sitting there and the patient is lying on the couch and the psychiatrist is saying, there, you shouldn't be so sad. Tell me, why do you want to kill yourself? That's one panel. And the next panel, the psychiatrist is standing on the ledge of the window about to jump because he says, you have convinced me. I should also kill myself. No. If that person was a terrible debt, who has a terrible disease, who has a lot of chronic pain and wants to die, if you cure that pain, if you pay off those debts, and then you used to tell the guy, so how do you feel now? Great. What about your plans for suicide? Oh, no, I don't want to kill myself. So it's only under certain problems that we, but by ourselves, we don't want to wipe out ourselves. So the self is never an object of displeasure. Now, we like things, we want to keep things which give us happiness. So if we like ourselves and we want to keep ourselves alive all the time, then it stands to reason we are always a source of happiness for ourselves. I'll repeat that. We want to keep things which are a source of happiness. If you give us happiness, I'll keep it. The moment it stops giving me happiness, I want to get rid of it or avoid it. Huh? Now, if I always want to keep myself alive, I always want my own company, that means I am a source of happiness to myself, even if you don't agree. It's a strange way of thinking, but it must be so. Not only am I always a source of happiness, keep these ideas in mind. You have to, you know, ponder or let them sink in. These are new and strange ways of thinking, unaccustomed ways of thinking. Then there is an associated argument. Not only am I always a source of happiness for myself, but it's not a trickle of happiness. I'm also the source of maximum happiness for myself. This is the second argument which Vidyaranya gives and which the author here is pointing towards. Is the second argument goes like this. If something is loved for the sake of something else, that something else is loved more than the first one. And remember, we always love things which give us happiness. Now, if something is loved, A is loved for the sake of B, you actually love B more than A. What does it mean? So, a classic example of a mother who loves the toys her kids play with. Now, if you ask, does she love the toys more or the kids more? Oh, you laugh. What a question. Of course, she loves the kids more. She loves the toys because of the kids. For the sake of the kids, because my son or daughter loves this toy, therefore it's also an object, it is something dear to me. Uh-huh. And it will continue to be dear to me. When the son and daughter grows up and is not concerned with the toys anymore, but mother will still love the toy because of the memories associated with the son or daughter. Uh-huh. So, whatever is loved for the sake of something else, that other thing is loved more. If you love something more, it means it's giving you more happiness. Now, if there is something for which everything else is loved, everything in the universe is loved for that one thing must be loved most of all. And that what you love most of all is something that must be giving you maximum happiness. And what do we love most of all? I always give this example. That sounds awful, but it's true in a very deep philosophical sense. It's not awful, it's beautiful actually. This person said, oh, I really love my job. And the example is this. I really love my job. It's a very nice job. And pays well. But yeah, it's not for the money. I love doing the job. All right. Then do the job. We won't pay you anymore. No. You have to pay me. Choose the job or the money. Suppose I were giving you an option. You don't have to do the job. We'll just give you the money. You earn $100,000 or something like that, and we'll just give you the money, you don't have to do anything. Or you do the job, but we won't give you anything. So I think most people would say that I want the money. All right, you get, so the money is loved more than the job. And if you get the money, suppose someone says, you can get the money, but you can't spend it. Ever. You can't invest it, spend it, nothing. And you say, no, I want to spend it. I want to use that money to buy things. All right, you can buy those things. I want to buy things for my family, for my friends, and so on. All right, you can buy those things for your family and friends and so on, but they won't be your family or friends. They'll be just some random people. No, they have to be my family and friends. You see, it comes back to me. The job is loved for the sake of the money. The money is loved for the sake of the things it buys. The sake of the things which it buys is loved for the sake of the people you buy it for. They must be your people. It comes back to me. Yeah. And if you will X for the sake of Y, then Y is loved more. Y for the sake of Z, then Z is loved more. Money is loved more than the job. The things it buys is loved more than the money. The people you buy it for are loved more than the things. And the people are related to the self. That's why you love them. So the self is loved more than the people. The self is the locus of maximum happiness and continuous happiness. So continuous happiness, maximum happiness, Atma, the self. Okay, so put them together. What do we have now? I am continuous existence. I am continuous awareness shining. I am continuous source of happiness for myself, continuous source of joy. This is what is called Sat Chit Ananda. Things of the world come and go. They are not Sat. Experiences, various kinds of conscious experiences come and go. They are not Chit. The various pleasures in the world and pains in the world come and go. They are not ananda. The continuous existence, consciousness, bliss, that is called Satchidananda. Then the author says triumphantly, Brahmaivaham atah siddham, siddham, hence proved. QED we say. Hence proved, I am Brahman. How? Look at your books. Open the books now. Satchidananda Lakshanam. It has been defined. What was our strategy? We will find the definition of Brahman. Then we'll look at it in our lives. We'll put them together and see. They're the same thing. Then I must honestly say now, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. All right. Let that sink in. Now we'll go ahead a little further. One more verse we'll take up and then I'll stop. 28 verses, they're all like this. Every possible question and doubt you could have. And you struggle against the fact, no, I am not Brahman. And tell me why. And I'll show you, you are Brahman. Without any possible doubt. See, the two things you have to keep together. One is the arguments which we just did. They're pretty simple. But strange. I mean, we don't think in those ways. Also, more importantly, the experiences these statements are pointing towards. The experience of I am-ness. The I am-ness is, however, it's not ego. If you stress the I, it becomes the ego. But the ego is not constant. In dream, in deep sleep, the ego disappears. You don't, nobody ever says, I am sleeping now. Then you're not sleeping. Sometimes mothers will see that the kids are tucked in, are they sleeping or not? And so-and-so is a good little boy. If he is really, truly asleep, his right big toe will move. And the boy moves his toe. So you know, he's not really asleep. I am, nobody says, I am asleep. Ego disappears. And yet you are not gone. I remember, you know, discussing this with a professor of the philosophy of mind at Harvard University. We were studying Descartes. And I said, so Descartes, I think, therefore I exist. And she said, yes. So when I do not think, I don't exist. So in deep sleep, I don't think. So Descartes popped out of existence every time he fell asleep, and he popped into existence every time he woke up. Never thought of that. Yes, even when I'm not thinking, I'm still there. I am is there. But the I is not stressed. The am-ness is stressed. So I am, I shine, I am always the object of greatest love for myself, so Satchidananda. Now, a question arises. Wait a minute, you're saying I am Brahman, but there's another definition of Brahman, quite apart from Satchidananda. In all the Upanishads, Brahman is the source of the universe. The universe was created by Brahman, in Brahman. It is the ground of the entire universe. Existence, the Srishti Sthiti Pralaya, the projection, existence and dissolution of the universe, the ground of that. In Sanskrit, Asya Jagata Janma Sthiti Bhanga Yasma Tad Brahma, of this universe, where from its origination, in which it exists, into which it finally dissolves, that is Brahman. Are you the source of the universe? You may think so, but I don't think so. You don't look like it. You don't look like you could do it. Are you in New York, or is New York in you? That in which the universe exists, is New York in you, or are you in New York? We are in New York. How can New York be in me, let alone the entire universe? So, the second definition, another definition of Brahman is, the Brahman is, you know, all the definitions of God in theistic religions. God is the creator of the universe. So Brahman is also the creator, preserver, and destroyer of the universe. In that case, how are you Brahman? So now the next big question, you have to prove, sarvagyam sarvakaranam, the cause, the creator of the entire universe. Not only that, omniscient, Brahman is omniscient. I clearly am not. I didn't create the universe. Don't ask me. I'm not responsible. Who created the universe? Not me. And yet, Vedanta insists, you are the cause of this entire universe. You are omniscient and so forth. How do you prove that? And the author is equal to the task. In the next verse, he's going to prove that. You are the source of the entire universe, and you are the cause of this entire universe, and you are omniscient also, to boot. And he'll do that. Let's see. I'm going to present a series of tightly interlocked arguments now. First, the second verse, and then. मय्येवोदेति चिद्व्योम्नि जगद्गन्धर्वपत्तनम् अतोऽहं कथं न ब्रह्म सर्वज्ञं सर्वकारणम्. इन् मी द स्काय् आफ् कान्शियस्नेस् चिद्व्योम चिदाकाश आकाश मीन्स् स्काय् व्योम मीन्स् स्काय् इन् मी द स्काय् आफ् कान्शियस्नेस् the universe arises like castles in the sky. Literal translation is like the city of the Gandharvas, which is what we, in English we have a phrase, castles in the sky. You know, you imagine things in the clouds, cities, people, whatever. When you go in the plains, it's like some persons are talking or something. Fantastic shapes in the clouds. So castles in the clouds, castles in the sky. The universe arises in me, which me, not this person. What we just discussed now, I am, constant I, the shining, constant I, who is never an object of displeasure or of lack of love for myself. So this existence, consciousness, bliss, in that the universe arises as a mirage, as a dream, like a movie on a screen, like a castles in the sky, a city of Gandharvas in the sky. Therefore, he is combative here. Ato aham katham na brahma. So how am I not Brahman? You are the cause of this universe and you are omniscient. So let's just look into this quickly and I'll stop. A set of arguments. Follow carefully. The first, we start where we left off. I am is constant in all our experiences. In all our experiences, I am is constant. But what we experience continually changes. The people in our lives come and go. The places we go to, we are different places we see. Time changes all the time from childhood to middle age to old age. Time is flowing. Body is changing. Mind is continuously changing. Thoughts are changing. Ideas are changing. Memories are arising and disappearing and being forgotten also. All of this is changing. And I am the constant. I amness, always shining, not changing in all experiences. Now, if things, here is the argument. Things which come into existence and disappear, we say, technically, they don't have intrinsic existence. They have borrowed existence. What's the argument here? This is being borrowed from the Bhagavad Gita. Second chapter, profound verse, 16th verse. Na sato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate satah. The unreal never has any existence. The real never goes out of existence. What does that mean? Consider this example. Hot potato, not metaphorically, a real hot potato. So the potato by itself, intrinsically, it's not hot. It's only when you have boiled it, it's hot. So it's borrowed its heat from the boiling water. What's the proof of that? Because it was not hot, it's hot now, and the heat will disappear. Once you serve it and put it on the plate, on the table, after some time, it will cool down. It's no longer a hot potato. So the heat is lost. If the heat comes and goes, it shows that it's not intrinsic to that object. It's not a property of that object. It was borrowed from something else. And we say, obviously, yes, the boiling water. But the boiling water doesn't have heat of its own. It's borrowed it from the hot saucepan under it. The hot saucepan also is not hot all the time. It's only when, you know, the electric heater or the fire which is burning underneath. That the saucepan borrows the heat from there and lends some of it to the water. And the water lends some of it to the potato. And our job is done. We have cooked the potato, boiled it. But the fire is interesting. The fire has not borrowed heat from anywhere else. The fire is intrinsically hot. As long as the fire is there and burning, it's going to be hot. Sort of common sense example. So it's intrinsically hot. The fire does not gain heat or lose heat. As long as it's there, it's hot. Every object that borrows heat from the fire gains the heat and loses it. And the characteristic of borrowing something is that you gain it and lose it. It should be obvious. We are in Manhattan, a debt society. You know, debt fueled by debt. People borrow all the time. There's a phrase, maxed out your cards. Maxed out your cards. What that means, you went on a shopping spree and you bought well beyond your means. And that's encouraged. That's what keeps the economy going. But then people can come and repossess your homes, your cars. And well, what happened? And the creditors came and took it away. You gained it and you had very high-flying Manhattan lifestyle. And then suddenly you lost it again. What happened? You didn't actually own it. It wasn't yours. It was on borrowed credit, on borrowed money. But if you are, this is a nice example. I was walking in the park and there was this guide showing people around. And near the lake, he showed people. So he was talking to tourists. This is called the West Side, Upper West. And this is called New Money. And this is people, the celebrities and tech people and all very rich people and famous people. And this he gives a list of, rattles of a list of people living in San Remo and what is that, El Dorado Towers and so on. And on the other side is East Side. That's called Old Money. So they have had it for generations. And then he said, where I come from, I'm from the Bronx. That's no money. So the sign of old money is that it doesn't come and go so easily. It belongs to you for a long time. So similarly, a characteristic which is intrinsically yours will not come and go. Now, so heat coming and going. Fire has intrinsic heat. The potato or the water or the saucepan does not have intrinsic heat. It came and went. But fire's heat does not come and go. Now, here's the philosophical question. If something has existence itself as an intrinsic property, then what will happen to it? If something has borrowed existence, what will happen to it? If you borrow something, what happens? It comes and goes. If you borrow existence, it will come and go. And borrowed existence, coming and going, another way of saying it is birth and death, creation and destruction. If something comes into being and goes out of being, born and died, created and destroyed, came into existence and disappeared from existence. It borrowed existence. But if something does not have borrowed existence, what will happen to it? It'll be existing. Yeah, it'll always be there. It'll be still. Great, that's a good way of putting it. It'll be always there. It'll never come into existence. It'll never go out of existence because it's old money, old existence. Existence belongs to it. Now, apply it to that I am. I am seeing flowers, hearing sound, meeting people. I'm young, and then I was young, now I am old. All of these flowers and sounds and people and places and jobs and young and old, all of them came and went. That means they don't have intrinsic existence. But I am, I shine, Sat Chit Ananda, that real nature, never comes and goes. It's always there. So I am has intrinsic existence. And whatever this I am experiences in life, none of it has intrinsic existence. It comes and goes. Therefore, it must have borrowed existence. Where will something borrow existence from? Where will the potato borrow its heat from? You say, from the boiling water. Not really. They have all borrowed their heat from fire. They may lend to each other, but they have borrowed it from fire. All this universe, what the author is driving at is, all this universe of experience, whatever you experience in this life, everything has borrowed existence from you, the I am. Not you, the body. Even the body has borrowed this experience from you, the I am. Not even you, the person. And that person comes and goes. In deep sleep, the person disappears. But the I am continues. The isness awareness continues. Just a little footnote. When I keep talking about existence as intrinsic property, those who are philosophically trained, if you're not philosophically trained, you are safe. But if you're philosophically trained, then you will immediately notice that existence cannot be a property. Bertrand Russell's theory of descriptions proves that very clearly. And what he pointed out was, when you say something has a property, the table is brown, what it means is there exists an entity called a table which has the property of being brown. Therefore, you cannot say existence is a property. Otherwise, how would you express it? There exists an entity called a table which has the property of existence. That sounds strange. It sounds even more strange when you say something does not have the property of existence, something died or is destroyed, then how would you say the table is destroyed? How would you say? You would say, and Bertrand Russell's theory of descriptions, there exists an entity called the table which doesn't exist. How strange. So existence cannot be a property. That's right. But we'll just set it aside. Many of you look puzzled. Don't worry about it. It's just a little extra thinking lands you in trouble. So, yeah, existence is not a property, but we are thinking that can be dealt with later. So, the one thing which does not have borrowed existence, I am. And everything else has borrowed existence. In that case, they must have all borrowed their existence from you, from the I am. Everything and everybody and every incident and every time and every place you have experienced has borrowed its existence from the I am. It appears as an other, but it depends on you for their existence. A good example is a dream. In a dream, you see people, you have experiences, you have your own personality in the dream also. And you meet people, you go to places, but when you wake up, you know for sure, whatever you saw, whomever you saw, whatever you did, including you yourself, the person in the dream, all of it borrowed its existence from the dreaming mind, from you, the dreamer. Isn't it? Uh-huh. The you, the dreamer, was like the I am in the present case. So, now this is called cause and effect. Effect, the table is an effect. The altar is an effect. What is the cause? The wood. It was wood earlier. Now it has been given the form of a table. That's been given the form of the altar. And one day these will be destroyed. It will still be wood. Before it was a table, before it was an altar, it was wood. And when it is a table, what is it? Touch. Touch wood. Be confident. Touch wood. Touch the altar, it's still touch wood. So when it is an effect, an altar, a product, table, product, altar. All sorts of products. You go there to IKEA, as long as you find wooden products, you know, they're all wood. So when all the products, all the effects, in all the effects, the cause continues. In all wooden furniture, wood continues. In all waves, water continues. In all golden ornament, gold continues. Gold is the cause of material cause of all the golden ornaments. Water is the material out of which all waves and foam and surf comes. And wood is the material out of which all wooden furniture comes. I am is the material out of which the universe of experience comes. I am is the cause, the material cause. And this universe, it is what becomes or, you know, this entire universe. Now the opponent might say, ah, got you. The cause is transformed into the effect. It is the seed which becomes the tree. The seed is gone, now it's a tree. It is the milk which becomes the yogurt. Now the milk is gone, it's yogurt now. If the cause is transformed into the effect, then you, the I am, the Satchidananda, the Brahman, has been transformed into this world. It's a world now. It is people, places, good and bad, you know, sky and earth. So you're gone. The I am is finished. Brahman is finished. It's just a world now. It's been transformed into the world. You say, aha, that's where the castles in the sky, the city of Gandharvas comes in. You say, no, but there's another kind of causality. In Vedanta, we talk about two kinds, parinama, transformation, vivarta, appearance. The seed is transformed into the tree. Milk is transformed into yogurt, true. But the rope is not transformed into the snake. The rope appears as the snake. The movie screen does not become the people and the places and things. It doesn't become a hero and a villain and chasing the hero. And then it doesn't become a car and a gunfight. No, it doesn't. It appears like a movie. In the dream, you, the dreamer, you don't actually become the places and go to the places and actually do those things which happened in the dream. That's why it's called a dream. It appeared in your mind. So that's another kind of causality, where the cause appears as the effect without transformation. In Vedanta, there's one word for all of this. It's called vivarta. Cause appearing as an effect, but without undergoing any change at all. The dry desert appears as the watery oasis, mirage. Not a drop of water there. It looks like that. The sand didn't suddenly become water. It just looks like that. Similarly, the claim here is consciousness, I amness, it doesn't change. So it can't transform into anything else. But it can appear as its own universe. Just like you yourself, sleeping happily in your bed, appear as a dream universe without actually transforming. Similarly, you appear as this universe of experience. What you appear as is not real, but you are real. That old story of King Janaka has become pretty popular. This was about 2004. I was in the Himalayas, staying in a little hut, meditating, studying, begging for my food. And I used to go for walks before sunset, in the very spectacular mountains, glaciers, and all of that. It was summer, so there was no snow there. It was comfortable. And once while walking, monks would tell stories. So this monk told me a story about the Emperor Janaka. So the Emperor Janaka, he went to bed one day, and suddenly he was woken up by a sentry. Your Majesty, wake up, wake up. What happened? What's the emergency? We have been attacked by the enemy. Oh, we have to attack by the enemy. Then call the general, call out the army, get my armor and my bow and arrows and sword. We must go out and fight the enemy. So he goes out and fights the enemy, but the poor Janaka is defeated by the enemy. And then he's captured and he's dragged before the enemy, the conquering enemy king. And the conqueror says, Janaka, you are of royal descent, you're of royal blood, so I will not kill you, but you are exiled from your kingdom. You're to get out from here before sunrise. So poor Janaka, what can he do? He struggles and walks and walks and walks. Now he's helpless. And somehow, wherever he goes for a drink of water or something, nobody wants to help him because the new king is cruel. And so somehow he manages to cross the border of his empire. If he does that before sunrise, it couldn't have been a very big empire. Anyway, so now he's in the next kingdom, and he is desperate and tired and wounded and exhausted and broken inside. And then he sees somebody giving food to the poor, like a soup kitchen. And he stands there. In India, it's a khichdi kitchen. There's the khichdi, that's the rice and dal and all. Yeah. Now, when it comes for his turn, there's a bowl, he comes to the place where it's being served. And at that moment, the person says, it's gone, it's finished. There's nothing left. And Janaka says, give me anything. I'm terribly exhausted. So they pick out a little bit of gruel at the bottom of the cauldron, and they serve that to him. And poor Janaka is going to drink that up. When a kite swoops down from the sky and knocks the bowl from his hand, it goes rolling. And Janaka falls helplessly on the ground. He can't take it anymore. And I heard it in Hindi. He said, ha ha kar karte ve, crying out, alas, alas. The Sanskrit ha ha is the exact opposite of the English ha ha. English ha ha is funny. So, Sanskrit ha ha means alas, alas. And he falls down. And he wakes up, sits up in his bed. At that point, we would have gone, oh, what a nightmare. What did I eat last night? But Janaka is a philosopher. He's a philosopher emperor. So he thinks, was that true or is this true? Yeah. In Hindi, was such? Yeah, ye such. Was that true or is this true? And the guard comes running and says, you shouted, is anything wrong? Was that true or is this true? The guard is scared and he goes and calls the queen. The queen says, now what is it, old man? And he says, was that true or is this true? She gets scared. She calls the royal doctor. The doctor examines him. Where does it hurt, emperor? Are you feeling unwell? Was that true or is this true? And he goes to court the next day. And he's sitting there and courtiers are coming and, business of the empire is being transacted. But he just says, the emperor just says one thing. Was that true or is this true? It could be a dream. The Chinese philosopher Chuangzi, he said, he went to sleep under a tree and he was dreaming that he was a butterfly. When he woke up, he said, but was I a philosopher dreaming that I was a butterfly, or am I a butterfly dreaming that I am a philosopher? Only a philosopher would ask such questions. Now the great sage Ashtavakra was visiting the city and he heard the gossip like the grapevine. Like there was no social media in those days, but it was like, but it was all over the city that this emperor has lost his marbles. He thinks, he just keeps saying, was that true or is this true? And then Ashtavakra goes to the court and he asks Janaka, how are you, your majesty? And he says, the emperor says, was that true or is this true? And Ashtavakra, who knows everything, what's in the mind of the emperor, he says, at that time when you were rolling in the dust and crying, alas, was all this there, the army, your glory, your power, your kingdom, or was it all lost? It's all lost. Nothing was there. None of this was there. And right now, when you're sitting in the midst of our glory and power, that defeat, that humiliation, that exhaustion, that pain, is it there now? He says, no, it's not there. Then Ashtavakra says, oh, emperor, neither that is true nor this is true. And the emperor says, good Lord, is nothing true then? When the sage says that at that time, did you experience it or not? He said, yes, you were there in some way. You experienced it. And here you're experiencing it, right? Yes. In that case, O emperor, neither that is true nor this is true, but you are the truth. You are the truth, that I am-ness, that I am, I shine, I am existence, consciousness, bliss, that is the truth. So, you are the cause of this entire universe. Remember the links of the argument. Intrinsic existence, borrowed existence, causality, cause is always, the effect borrows its existence from the cause, cause is always there in the effect, and therefore, and this is a kind of causality which is vivarta, no transformation, appearing like a city of Gandharvas or castles in the sky. This entire universe is a dreamlike appearance in you, the I am, the ever-shining I am. Very quickly, how does that make me all-knowing? I'll just touch upon that and finish. Sarvajnam. All the things in this universe, whatever we experience, they know neither themselves nor anything else. The table doesn't know itself. And the table doesn't know the altar. But I, the consciousness, I know the table and I know the altar. I see it, I can touch it, and so on and so forth. So the objects in the universe, objects of consciousness, whatever you experience in the universe, they are not aware of each other. Yeah. And not only that, and they are not aware of themselves also. You might say, Swami, hold on. I'm aware of all of these people and all of these people and all animals and all. They're all aware of each other. But bodies are not aware of each other. It's the consciousness which is reflected in and through the mind. So this whole Vedantic epistemology is there. That's what makes you aware of yourself and everything else. It is consciousness alone which is the knower. In every episode of knowing, Vedantic epistemology is consciousness makes possible knowledge. And your own experience, look at it. Just what did we do at the very beginning? We did that, I am, and I am aware of you. I can see you. I close my eyes, I can't see you, but I still am. But if I leave that I am out, if I push that out, then all knowledge disappears. Right? So consciousness is that which knows through a mechanism, through instruments. Same consciousness, through the mind, through the eyes, sees the object and says, I see. I am and I see. Through the ears, the mind and the ears, same consciousness, I hear. Through the mind, I think. But if mind, ears, eyes, all were taken away, I am would still be there. But it would not see or hear or smell or taste or think. But if you took the I am away, no knowledge would be possible at all. That's why, all this AI, talk of AI, there's no real knowledge there. There's no first-person experience of knowing because consciousness is the only thing that has not been simulated there. Everything else is there, intelligence, memory, creativity, all of that. So all knowledge is knowledge by consciousness. Whatever is known, wherever it is known, it is consciousness that knows. You can say, yeah, just a minute, but I am not omniscient. But you're thinking of I am in limitation with this mind and body. The same consciousness, you the one consciousness, functioning through all sentient beings, you know the things in this universe. Somebody might say that, yeah, but there might be things which no sentient being knows. There might be a planet far away in the cosmos somewhere, no living being is there. So don't you think that planet exists, and it exists outside consciousness. And the one answer is, one simple answer is that, no, but God is there. So God is omniscient. God knows everything. And in God's mind, where all knowledge is there, that's illumined by consciousness, that same I amness. So you as I amness through God's mind, you're omniscient. That kind of argument may be given. A deeper, more profound and subtle argument is this. I mentioned this earlier. You don't have to bring God into it. In one sense, everything is in our consciousness and illumined by our consciousness. Just that some of it is known, some of it is unknown. When you say sarvagyam, all-knowing, it means, there's a derivation, you are the all and you are consciousness. Sarvascha gyascha, all consciousness. The example which I give to Bill Conrad, I'll repeat it, I've told it many times, I'll say that and finish. It's this, that one day Bill told me, it's not true that everything is in consciousness, Swami. There are things outside consciousness, I'll prove it to you now. So in this room, let's all go out of this room. We'll put a camera in this room. It'll record the room. And we'll go out of the room. When we come back into the room, Swami, I will show you the pictures in the camera. You will see a room existing without any conscious being. The room exists outside consciousness. And then we see it. This is what is called realism in a philosophical sense. That the world exists and then we come and see it. Now I said to him, Bill, in your consciousness, you saw this room. And in you, the consciousness, you proposed this experiment that put up a camera here. In you, the consciousness, the camera was set up and switched on. In you, the consciousness, you experienced us leaving the room. In you, the consciousness, you experienced us coming back into the room. In you, the consciousness, we experienced the camera showing an empty room, you know, pictures of that. Where did you step outside consciousness? I'll give you one more example. In our dreams, we have the experience of meeting people, doing things, but we also have the intuition of our wider world out there. Follow what I'm saying carefully. In our dreams, suppose we are walking around in Central Park and meeting people, we also have this feeling that I am in the middle of a world. We feel it's like a waking world. And there's a vast world out there, New York and the United States and the Atlantic Ocean and so on. I know only a slice of it, this Central Park, a little bit in front of me. But when I wake up, what happens? Whatever I saw in the dream, known and unknown, experienced and not experienced, the whole thing was in the dreaming mind, as known and as unknown. So knowledge, which is called prama in Sanskrit, is different from chaitanya, consciousness. Consciousness makes all knowledge possible. Whatever is known and whatever is unknown, it's only in the field of consciousness. So you are, in that sense, sarvagya. And now the author has demonstrated the second definition of Brahman. Brahman is the ground of the entire universe. The whole universe arises in Brahman, exists in Brahman, disappears back into Brahman. Brahman is the cause of the universe and has shown you as the I am, the ever-shining I am. The whole universe arises in you, is experienced in you the consciousness, not in you the person, and disappears back into you. It is not separate from you. There is not one person here, one object here, one event here which you experience, which is actually anything other than you. You are this universe. This is called non-duality. This is the honey of non-duality. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Shri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.